Before we get into today's podcast, I wanted to let you know about a special ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Five Ways to Connect with God, Ancient Practices for Modern Times. It's safe to say that in today's fast-paced culture, we're all seeking more rest and less chaos. Only then can we find true connection with our Creator. Five Ways to Connect to God offers five unique spiritual principles to Christians who may be feeling dry when it comes to their prayer life or spiritual fervor. These include practices such as choosing a word for the year, the power of one-phrase prayers, and the importance of cultivating thankfulness. Some of these principles are hundreds of years old, yet they offer a fresh way to connect us with the living God. Download your copy of Five Ways to Connect to God by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Who controls the levers of power in America? Some are controlled by the House, some by the Senate, others by the President, who nominates Supreme Court justices. They can protect your free exercise of faith or take it away. Their rulings last for generations, impacting your kids and grandkids. Think about choosing your next president, because the ultimate lever of power is controlled by you. Your vote matters because the Supreme Court matters. Paid for by First Liberty Institute.
Welcome to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. We hope you enjoy the conversation and do let us know what you think. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk and leave comments on our Facebook page, Premier Unbelievable, or tweet us at UnbelievableFE. For many more resources to help both believers and skeptics to explore faith, please visit our website, premierunbelievable.com. Registering there will unlock access to all content on the website, as well as giving you special access through the weekly newsletter to exclusive content such as bonus videos and ebooks. That's premierunbelievable.com. And now, here's today's Unbelievable Classic Replay, hosted by Justin Briley from 2016.
So today on the programme, we're asking, does the problem of evil presuppose God? The problem of suffering and evil is, of course, a common objection to Christianity. How could a good God allow so much suffering if he has the power to change it? Well, it's a question that has Christians and non-Christians have struggled with for millennia. Helping us to think through the issue today from this particular angle that we're addressing it are Josh Parikh and Corey Markham. Corey's been on the programme before. You may remember he joined us for a discussion on intelligent design last year with Jonathan McClatchy. Josh is new to the programme, however. So, Josh, welcome along to Unbelievable.
Thanks very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. We share a little bit of background, interestingly, because you're an Oxford undergraduate studying PPE, Politics, Philosophy and Economics, which was what I studied at Oxford.
Great minds think alike.
Hopefully, who knows. What's got you into apologetics as a sort of sideline in your undergraduate career?
So I'm particularly interested in philosophy, that philosophy has been my major interest academically, and that I'm also very interested in philosophy of religion there. And so looking at some of the kind of big thinkers there, people like William Lane Craig have been very interesting to me. Then I also I've grown up in a Christian family, and growing up in a Christian family, I became a Christian quite early on, which meant that at school, I was confronted with kind of friends who were atheists much earlier on, and meant that I had to kind of wrestle with the big questions, the kind of things like the problem of evil, things like the relationship between science and religion much earlier on than kind of other people, which meant that I had to think about these questions for the first time.
Do you find that also in the university setting that you're having to confront a lot of people who are sceptical?
Absolutely. And so, in fact, last night that I was at a Texas Toastie, where we go around giving out toasties for free to people and answering people's questions.
Is this the Christian Union that you're part of?
This is it, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That I believe certain other people have been members of in the past. and that going around answering people's questions, seeing what their big questions are, seeing if there are questions we've got for them, things like that. And so definitely lots of big questions to come around at university.
That's really interesting. One of my big regrets, actually, doing PPE at Oxford was that I don't know why I didn't do the paper on philosophy of religion, which would have made a lot of sense given what I now do as a job.
Right.
Is that one you have gone for?
So I'm doing that next term. So that I've kind of done a bit of research before on this, and I went to some lectures last term by Brian Leftow, who's a reasonably well-known philosopher of religion.
I mean, I think I didn't appreciate what an opportunity I had actually while I was at university to sit under the instruction and teaching of some of now people I consider amazing philosophers. Obviously, at the time, I was less aware of the standing of some of these people who I could potentially have had teaching me. But it's an extraordinary opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm massively lucky that kind of the background I've had and being able to be where I am now, but try to use it the best I can.
So. Yeah. Well, you and Corey came to me with this suggestion of a show looking at the problem of evil, and particularly whether it presupposes God in the first place. This is the argument you're going to be making on the show today. So we'll get to that, Josh. Our other guest is Corey Markham, who joins us by phone from the US of A, where he is based. Corey, thank you for coming back on the programme today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show again. I'm happy to be here.
Corey, you're a contributor to the Atheist Republic website, and you're a former Christian yourself. You had a journey towards atheism, though. We heard about that last time you joined me on the programme. And so we won't tread too much of that ground again. Kind of where we got to on the programme last time was the problem of suffering, which was kind of a little bit of a tangent from the issue of intelligent design, which is where we started out from. But has this been a significant issue in your own loss of faith, the issue of suffering and evil?
In a way, yes. It's important to clarify right off the bat that when we talk about the problem of evil, and Josh and I will get into this in a few moments, no doubt, there's different angles you can take. And so sort of roughly divided into the theoretical problem of evil, or then you have the existential problem of evil. The theoretical problem of evil would be like the logical problem of evil and the evidential argument from evil, the sort of stuff that we're going to get into again in this episode. But the existential problem of evil is more to do with just the individual as they deal with suffering and what we might call evil in their life, and how that affects their faith and their outlook and whatnot. And so in that way, I mean, absolutely, as I sort of went over in the last episode, one of the contributing factors to my loss of faith and then eventually to becoming an atheist was the experience of suffering and personal loss. Not to say that was the only thing, of course, but that was a huge part of it. And it certainly was a huge part, and initially to at least get me start questioning God and some of the things that I had taken for granted. So, I lost my faith, and then it was interesting because I wasn't really all that interested in religion when I was religious. It was really more so after the fact. A few years after having lost my faith, becoming an atheist, I just sort of realized that I was really fascinated with the topics and philosophy and religious studies and whatnot. So. Yeah, so I went and earned my bachelor's degree in philosophy and religion, and now I'm in sort of limbo waiting to get into graduate programs here when I start applying in the next couple of years.
Right, so, yeah. Okay, so you may continue going down the academic route for a little while at least.
Hopefully, yes.
well, I'm really pleased to have two young men joining me who obviously sit on different sides of the faith divide, but are going to be, I'm sure, having an interesting conversation. You guys already know each other. I think we should say
the
outset.
Yeah. Josh is very, very, very nice gentleman.
And Corey is a lovely guy too. So return the compliment.
It's all roses already. But I will post up some links to where you guys more can be found out about you both and what you do with today's program. If you want to listen back to today's show, send it on to someone else. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the website address. If you want to feed me back your comments on today's programme, do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'd be delighted to hear your feedback. We'll read out some of the last set of comments from the last few weeks of programming towards the end of today's show. You can find us online as well on the social media sites @unbelievablejb for the Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to become a fan of the Facebook page and find out what's going on that way. All the links and more, as ever, available from the website. Let's get into today's discussion.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we're talking about the problem of evil on Unbelievable today. And does the problem of evil presuppose God? Well, probably what we should first of all do is hear the problem of evil outlined. And probably you're the best man to do that at this point, Corey. So do you want to just spell out how you would put the problem of evil to someone?
Sure. So as I said, you know, there's the sort of the existential problem of evil, which just has to do with the individual and how they deal with the problem of suffering in their life and the world in general. But then there's the more theoretical dimension of this discussion. And so roughly speaking, this is split up into the logical argument from evil or the evidential argument from evil. But I think probably the most famous or infamous example of the logical problem of evil comes from J.L. Mackey. And essentially what he argued is that the following two statements were logically incompatible with one another. So the first statement is that God exists, and the second statement that evil exists. Now, he unloaded a bit more, of course, by sort of qualifying it and saying the reason that is the case because an omnipotent being would have the power to stop evil, an omniscient being would have the knowledge of evil when it was going to happen, and an omnibenevolent being would have the inclination or desire to stop it, and so would stop it. For many different reasons, the logical problem of evil has sort of gone by the wayside. I mean, not that there aren't atheistic philosophers that still use it, but in a large part, the discussion has moved more towards the evidential version. And essentially, it's you can frame it almost precisely the same way. The idea here, though, is that we're not talking simply about logical incompatibility or inconsistency. We're saying what is more likely the case, that there is a God or that there is not a God given the suffering that we experience. And so I think it helps to really get more, because we can get too academic and zoomed out about this stuff. And I think it's important to get into the details, so at least a little bit here. And so, you know, I won't go on too much, but let me just list a couple like more graphic illustrations of what I take and would point at as the problem of suffering. And so I believe it was in 2004 or so, we had the Indian Ocean tsunami, right? And so try thinking about the problem of evil like this. To believe in God, you have to believe that God knew in advance that this ocean tsunami, that this Indian Ocean tsunami, which killed 200,000 people, was going to happen, and nevertheless stood or floated or whatever nearby without so much as lifting a metaphorical finger to prevent it. Some people in the tragedy were taken and dragged out to sea and drowned. Others were smashed or torn apart like rag dolls between cars, trees, or any of the other countless hard objects. Some of these people were suddenly drowned within their homes. So just imagine that for a second, guys. Like, one moment you're sitting in your living room or in that studio with your family and friends, and then all of a sudden your house is flooded and you're all drowning to death. And nearly a third of the bodies recovered in the aftermath of this tsunami were children, too, which is particularly horrible. And they think this is probably the result of children just not having the required strength to fight off the waters, right? I hesitate. I don't want to just, rub anyone's face in it too much, because on some level it gets to the point where I'm perhaps just appealing to your emotions. But again, I wanted to at least give some sort of graphic, specific example of what we're talking about, because I fear when we get too academic about it, we just sort of lose sight on the reality of the suffering.
And you gave similarly at the end of the last show we did a graphic example of a sort of skin condition that can leave someone really, really in a horrible state, and I think it is important, however uncomfortable it is to hear, to be confronted with. These are the harsh realities of the world we live in. These are the dreadful natural disasters that occur. These are the congenital conditions that people can be born with. So many things which in many ways do seem beyond the sort of typical defense of free will. If you're suffering because someone robbed your house, you could say, that to override that person's free, the robber's free will goes against the principle of freedom, and so we have to understand that these kinds of things are part of living in a free world. But then it's harder to make that same justification for something like a tsunami.
That's right.
So you've spelled out the problem very, very succinctly there, and graphically why did God not lift a metaphorical finger, as you say, in light of the terrible suffering and death that occurred in the tsunami. One of the hardest questions, I think, questions that Christians face, Josh, I'm sure you'd agree.
I completely agree, and I want to absolutely affirm with Corey that we need to be careful not to make this just an abstract issue that doesn't affect our emotions at all, that we need to be careful to make sure that this is about real people, this is about real life events, rather than kind of armchair discussions.
Yeah.
That I think partly because of that, I'm more convinced that evil is a reality. And so there's a fascinating book by Romeo Dallaire where he called Shake Hands with the Devil, which he was the UN peacekeeper for the Rwandan genocide. And he saw some of the most horrific evil that you can ever think of. And that while seeing this horrific evil, he is asked at the beginning of the book, because he's a Christian, and is asked at the beginning of this book that why do you believe in a God when you've seen such horrific evil? And he says at the beginning of this book that I believe in a God because in Rwanda I shook hands with the devil. And that I'm not appealing to some sort of spiritual being there, that although I would believe in that, what I'm saying is the very reality of evil seems to point to the fact that there really is a God.
Just unpack that for us then, because I think this is where we're going to be first, at least in this program, talking about this subject. We've asked the question, does the problem of evil presuppose God? Now, most people would say it's the biggest thing that counts against God. It's the biggest objection to the existence of God, as Corey has sort of shown there. So what, just give us how you would then actually say actually the problem of evil presupposes the existence of God.
Right, yeah, and it kind of seems like I'm being slightly counterintuitive with that. But what I'd say is that when we talk about the problem of evil, we are making certain moral judgments, saying we know what evil is, saying we know what God's character would be, and that if God is a good God, what he would then prevent. I think that moral knowledge would be incompatible, or at least very, very improbable, if atheism is true. I think that this is kind of a line of argument that which is famously put forward by C.S. Lewis, that he says that I have an idea of injustice, but where did my idea of injustice come from? That a man cannot call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. And that I think the idea of moral facts don't fit particularly well with an atheistic worldview. The fact that they are prescriptive rather than descriptive, that they are saying what ought to be rather than what is very strange in a world where everything else seems to be descriptive. Every other fact seems to be descriptive. That doesn't make a lot of sense with an atheistic worldview. I'd also say that moral knowledge itself is very difficult to justify on an atheistic worldview, that it seems that as a result of the evolutionary process, that our basic moral orientation is evolutionary determined, that beliefs like suffering is bad and death is bad and socializing and family is good. But if the evolutionary process is radically contingent, as evolutionary naturalism or some sort of atheism with evolution would be, then this would mean that we could have had plenty of other moral orientations. And so, for example, Charles Darwin says that if men were reared under precisely the same conditions as hyphes, there could be hardly a doubt that our unmarried females would think it a sacred duty to kill their brothers, and lots of other different moral orientations.
So if morality is simply a product of our evolutionary environment, then there's no sort of prescriptive morality, there is no objective morality. And this point you make that how can we speak, as C.S. Lewis said, of good and evil if there is nothing out there by which to judge something good or evil? So this is, I guess, at the heart of this reason why you believe the problem of evil does presuppose God. You can't speak of evil without believing there is someone who delineates evil and good.
Yeah, and I'd want to slightly clarify that it's not, the second argument is not necessarily saying that moral facts don't exist. I think the kind of first argument would be that moral facts don't exist. The second is to say that even if moral facts did exist, then the fact that our moral beliefs seem to be a product of our evolutionary process, that means that we couldn't even know that moral facts, what the moral facts would be, even if there were moral facts out there. And so exactly, that's kind of the idea that we know what is evil and we know what a good God would do seems to me to be something that is unjustified on an atheistic worldview.
Right. So there's kind of two angles from which you would question Corey's confidence in the problem of evil and suffering. Corey, how do you begin to respond to this particular way then of looking at the problem of evil?
Yeah, well, so I think there's a couple kind of preliminary remarks I would want to make before just sort of launching my direct response to that. So the first would be, so much of this is inspired from a paper that Josh actually wrote, and I'm actually working on a paper in response. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where a lot of this is coming from. But I think an important thing right off the bat is to note that there's a difference between atheism and naturalism. And now this may be counterintuitive at first, but maybe I could just put it like this. I think that atheism does follow necessarily from naturalism. So in other words, you know, if naturalism is true, then there is no supernatural, and therefore atheism is true. There's no gods, right? But I don't think it works the other way around. So I don't think that naturalism necessarily follows from atheism. And I say that because I think a lot of the, at least part of the critique here is probably better launched at just a strict naturalist. In other words, I, as an atheist, I'm not necessarily beholden to just naturalism. And so, you know...
So are you saying that an atheist who doesn't believe in God could still believe in some kind of supernatural things, i.e...
Technically, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But Platonic ideals, for instance, might come into
I
think this was
exactly
the line that Stephen Law argued against William Lane Craig back in the debate I hosted between them in 2011. He didn't want to let go of objective moral facts. And he said, well, I'd only really have to do that if I was fully committed to a kind of strict naturalism. And you seem to be making the same kind of argument there.
Well, exactly, and more, a lot of this has to do with just I'm not entirely sure what naturalism as opposed to supernaturalism, what those words even mean. It's not clear to me. I've never really been given all that great of definitions. They kind of are just defined in contrast to one another, but you know, as to what they are specifically, it's hard to really tease that out. And so, as a young budding philosopher, I'm skeptical of that sort of thing in general. And I don't want to box myself in, I should also say. But now, I say that, and that sort of leads into the point that you just sort of suggested that it was Stephen Law. And I think there's, for the rest of this discussion, after I make this quick point, I'm more than happy to just sort of adopt a moral non-realist or nihilist position so we can have this specific mm-hmm. discussion, but I don't concede as an atheist that that atheism entails moral nihilism or non-realism. And it's worth noting too, not to simply appeal to authority, but to give the proper context, that you know the majority of contemporary philosophers also don't concede that. The last time I saw like a relevant survey of this issue, most philosophers have an atheistic view. It was somewhere around 60-70%. But also most of philosophers have a moral realist position, and so that shows that they're... for what it's worth, that doesn't mean that they're right or something like that. It's just worth noting that this is a common point that's launched in these sort of debates and in more public debates, but it's not really an argument that's taken all that seriously in moral philosophy.
It depends. I mean, I think you're probably right, and Josh, I don't know if this is your experience, that when it comes to philosophy, atheists tend to be less willing to commit full-bloodedly to naturalism. You tend to find that more with a scientific atheist like Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, who seem quite happy to commit themselves to a kind of very strict naturalism.
Yeah, I think that there's one of the interesting things that Corey brought up was the idea of what is naturalism, that this is a big debate, that some people talk about metaphysical naturalism, which basically means that the natural world is all there is. I think the best way of characterizing naturalism is how Michael Rea characterizes it, which says that the best way of finding out facts about the external world is through science, and that scientific methods are the best way of finding out facts. I think Corey's brought up a couple of points there. That one, I agree that atheism doesn't entail moral non-realism. But what I would say is that what I'm presenting is similarly as to Corey's presented the logical problem of evil versus the evidential problem of evil, that I think I'd appeal to a logical problem of moral realism versus an evidential problem of moral realism. And as I see it, I think the evidence shows that it's improbable that we could have moral knowledge if naturalism, or atheism for that matter, is true.
Yeah, I mean, what's your take on this, Corey? Do you think that to speak of evil in the first place does mean you have to appeal to some kind of moral realism in order to justify that statement?
I don't. And so that sort of gets us right into where we want to be, because interestingly enough, like this is a question that has come up many times and came up specifically in the law the William Lane Craig debate that you mentioned. And I would more or less take the two objections that Stephen Law proposed in that discussion and use those. And interestingly, those were the two objections that Josh dealt with in his paper, where he gets into this. The two, you know, most likely responses that an atheist would have in response to Josh's argument. And so the first would be, essentially, it's as counterintuitive as it is, and a lot of this is counterintuitive, apparently. I think you can run the problem of evil without actually using or making use of the concept of evil. And so the idea here is that you would essentially run a problem of gratuitous suffering. And gratuitous suffering just here refers to the experience of unnecessary physical or mental pain / discomfort, and therefore needn't refer to the sort of nebulous, almost supernaturalist, religious-minded notions of evil. So, in other words, I think we could dumb it down, if you will, and not actually appeal to these abstract notions of good and evil in such a way that gets around that.
Maybe the term evil is a bit of a red herring in that sense. It would be the argument there, and we're really just talking about suffering, pain, you know, and that where it seems gratuitous, i.e., unjustified for any greater purpose, then we are justified to say that this is not in keeping with what we would expect of a God of love and so on. Loads of stuff to unpack there, and we'll do that on the other half of a quick break. We're going to a quick break now, and we'll be back with my guest today on Unbelievable, Josh Parikh and Corey Markham. Josh is our Christian in studio with me, Corey our atheist on the line from the US, and we're debating whether the problem of evil presupposes God. It's a question that's always comes around, has never gone away, the problem of suffering and evil. And we're going to see what Josh has to say in response to Corey there in the next section of today's program. I'm Justin Braley, your host for the program that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
All of us have wondered what happens after we die, and I'm excited to say that N.T. Wright has written an amazing book called Surprised by Hope that provides a fresh perspective and incredible insight on this crucial subject. This powerful book is our gift to you today to say thank you for your financial support of Premier Insight this month. Dive deep into the biblical understanding of life after death and how it can transform your life. Supplies are limited, so don't miss out. Go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. And don't forget to request your copy of Surprised by Hope. Thanks for your support.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. I'm Justin Braley, your host for Unbelievable, and we're going to be continuing our discussion in a moment's time on the problem of evil and whether it actually presupposes God. Josh and Corey join me on the programme today to talk about that. If you want to find out more about Unbelievable, and specifically Unbelievable, the conference 2016, do check out the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I mentioned we're going to be hearing some of your feedback later on in the programme. We've had some interesting debates recently, especially last week's. Loads of feedback on whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God. Nabil Qureshi and Joseph Cumming were my guests last week for that. So listen out for that a little bit later on. If you can stay on after Unbelievable, between 4 and 5, you can hear me talking to George Osborne. Very interesting story. if you're an atheist, I'm not sure what you'd make of it, actually. But he had what he would call demonic possession. He was in the grip of demons, and he believes that Christ set him free from that. We're going to be hearing his really interesting story between 4 and 5 this afternoon. So if you can hang around, that's who you'll be hearing this Saturday afternoon. Right now, back into the discussion as we ask, does the problem of evil presuppose God? So Josh Parikh is an Oxford undergraduate with an interest in apologetics. It reminds me a little bit of myself at your age, Josh, because I developed an apologetics at around the same time at university. Corey Markham has developed himself an interest in apologetics, or you could call it counter-apologetics, as an atheist. And he's our other guest on the line from the States. And we got to the point there of Corey coming back to say, okay, we don't need to necessarily use the term evil, Josh. If that's a problem, if that seems to suggest that we're talking about some moral realism world which we need God to justify, let's just talk about suffering. Let's just talk about gratuitous pain, and that kind of thing. Do we need to involve these slightly metaphysical notions of evil and good and so on? So what's your response to that?
So my response would be to this idea that I still think that by using suffering, we are still presupposing that suffering would be something that God would want to prevent. If there is no moral knowledge, then that's a problem, because there are lots of things that exist. So, for example, trees exist or paperclips exist. And so why wouldn't it be the case that God would want to prevent the existence of paperclips? And so the reason that we say that God would want to prevent the existence of suffering rather than rocks or trees or paperclips is because we think that suffering is bad, and we think that suffering is something that God would want to prevent. As a result, I don't think this response to kind of rephrase the problem of evil in this way really works.
Okay, so it's a semantic thing for you. At the end of the day, if you're still concerned about suffering, if it's still a problem in some way, it's got a moral dimension. You just can't get away from that.
I think so.
What's your take on that, Corey?
Well, it's interesting because I like to call this the semantic objection, but I don't mean semantic in a negative connotation. I just mean that it is a matter of clarifying terms here. But yeah, I think first of all, let me say that I was impressed by Josh by his arguments here. Before having met Josh and getting into what he has specifically said on these issues, I sort of thought this was a non-starter. This is a really a silly issue. Mm. And I was just like, come on, theist. You know, like, you're not even going to let us run the problem of evil without... It reminds me of, like, the transcendental argument where some theist will take that line, you know, that, oh, well, you can't even use logic without presupposing God. And it's just like, okay, well, then let's just not discuss anything anymore. It seems to me that we don't really need to know that gratuitous suffering is bad, or in other words, we don't really need moral knowledge to see why the sort of God that we're talking about would seek to avoid it. And so maybe if we could just qualify, maybe I'd just talk about a loving God, okay? So it just seems to me that the concept, though the concept of a loving God can have moral implications, it doesn't necessarily have moral implications. And so I would argue that it seems to follow from the very idea of a loving, let alone a perfectly loving, mind you, God, irrespective of the existence or non-existence of moral facts, that such a God would seek to avoid gratuitous suffering for his creatures whenever possible. I mean, it's just his inclination to do so, I would say, follows merely from the fact of his loving nature. If I love my child, for instance, I don't have a child yet, but I will see her soon, I would want to protect my child from gratuitous suffering whenever I could. And my reasoning for doing so may simply be that I love my child. And so hence it's neither here nor there if my doing so or if my love for the child
isn't the point that if you failed to protect your child, consciously failed to protect your child from suffering, you would be a bad person. You would be evil. You would have done something wrong. Isn't that the point Josh is making, that you can't get away from, at some point down the line, the problem of there is a moral issue at stake?
Well, so that's a perfect segue into my second objection. And what I was going to say initially is that the first objection sort of spills over into the second one in precisely the way you just described. So, but again, I want to stress this one more time. Just, I think that if there to reject my line of reasoning, it seems, right, you have to reject the following premise. So if there exists a loving being capable of shielding its conscious creatures from unnecessary suffering, such a being would seek to do so. That's all I'm trying to say here. Now, but more importantly, yeah, I think, now the second aspect of this is what's called, problem of evil is what's called an internal critique, okay? And so the basic idea here is that what we're doing when we run the problem of evil is we're pointing towards certain inconsistencies within the theistic paradigm in order to demonstrate logical inconsistency and incompatibility within that view. And so it's sort of like I'm standing to the side from the outside, pointing in at certain okay. things within yeah. the theistic view. And so if it is the case that a theist has any reason to believe that their God would seek to avoid unnecessary suffering, right, then that seems to me all that we need to have this problem for it to go through. And so I could be a nihilist, morally speaking. I could be a realist, like Sam Harris or Shelley Kagan or Eric Uhlenberg, or I could be a subjectivist, an emotivist. It really doesn't matter insofar that I'm just pointing towards certain things within the theistic view that I take to be
internally inconsistent in that sense. Okay, Josh, lots to unpack there again.
Lots to unpack there. I would agree with Justin in that I still think you're smuggling in some moral assumptions there about what. So the idea that, for example, that a loving God would prevent the suffering of conscious creatures, I still believe that involves some moral knowledge that suffering would be bad. Why wouldn't it be the case that a loving God would want to maximise the number of paperclips, for example, that it requires moral knowledge, as I see it.
And doesn't the whole argument hinge for me, just to get this clear, that there's two moral issues at stake. There's the question of the suffering being moral evil, but also that God is wrong, morally wrong,
correct,
to not intervene in the suffering.
Exactly.
So there's a moral question at stake somewhere.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that I think that's the weaker of the two positions on it. A more interesting one is the kind of second thing I think that Corey's brought up, which is the idea of it being an internal critique. I think I'd want to make a distinction between theism and Christian theism, and then we can talk about Christian theism afterwards, but particularly on theism. What I want to say there is that if there is no moral knowledge, then if you're saying that naturalism or atheism, that whichever, if you're saying that atheism is true, then you're then positing what the world would be like and what would be moral if God did exist. And I think that's, if moral knowledge itself is difficult to have, then I think knowledge of what would be moral in another, what's called a possible world, knowledge of what would be the case there, I think is even more difficult to find.
So the atheist making the case that your Christianity is inconsistent because if this God existed, right, he would have to act like this. You're saying the atheist is taking on a great deal to claim to know how this God should exist if such a God existed.
Exactly, and what would be wrong, and kind of what the suffering would be wrong over the kind of anything else. And so, yes.
Yeah. How much of that do you take on board, Corey, that you know, you're in a limited position to say how a loving God should and would act if a loving God did exist?
Well, there's an interesting distinction there between would and should, right? And so I'm not necessarily say that God should, or the hypothetically God should act in this way, that he is obligated in some sense, and partly because I don't think that all theists even agree that God has any moral obligation. Some, like Craig, for instance, would argue that he doesn't, and so that he has no obligations whatsoever, and so this doesn't work in that sense. But I still think that for many theists, intuitively at least, there does seem to be. So maybe look at it like this. Imagine that atheism is true and that there is no God. It seems to me that there can still be what we call love in the world, insofar as we're talking about beings like us, right? The sort of the regard that we feel towards other people. And so we can make sense of the concept of love in that context, and the idea being that if you love someone, then you would seek to avoid any sort of unnecessary suffering for that person. I think that there is a moral dimension to that, or there can be, but I don't think there has to be. I think that we can just make that basic intuitive point. And again, if you don't agree with that, so perhaps getting into the more specific theism, Christian theism as opposed to just theism, well, then that's fine. You know, then this doesn't work. But so this specifically is just pointing to those people that grant that point, though. You know, that simple idea, and if you do, then there does seem to be a problem here, and we don't have to necessarily get into the more. Something. It's interesting because I was a bit at first was impressed with some of Josh's lines of reasoning here, and certainly more so than my normal exposure to this argument. But there was a couple things that he in his paper and he sort of teased out there in his response there that kind of raised other problems for me. And so one of the problems is, and maybe Josh, I can just ask you directly. Would you, at some point in your paper when I was going through it, you seemed to suggest that perhaps, and this is going to take us a bit off the specific topic for a moment, but you seemed to suggest at one point that perhaps moral truths are necessary truths, so like logical truths, something like that. Was that right? Is that fair? Would you say that, or was that misreading you?
No, I think that's right, that I would say that moral truths are necessary truths. I'll be interested to see where you go here. Okay.
Yeah, well, I guess it seems to me that if you grant that moral truths are necessary truths, then moral truths exist regardless of whether or not God exists. So they're not contingent. They're not contingent about anything, not upon God or anything else. But if that's the case, then then again, sort of skirting the immediate issue that we're getting into here, I don't see why an atheist can't have, moral
values. It's a form of Euthyphro's dilemma, which is essentially, well, if moral facts exist independent of God, then we just, we don't need God, we just need the moral facts, I suppose. But
then yeah. I know that's a tangent, but I just real quick.
Well, no, it's a common response to the issue of the moral argument, and that's part of what we're talking about here with this response to the problem of suffering. So, do you want to tackle that one quickly?
Yeah, no,
George?
Sure, I'll tackle that one quickly. That I agree that that it's a necessary truth that moral facts are necessary truths. But I'd further say that I'm convinced kind of by a number of factors by what's called the ontological argument, and that what that would mean is that God would be a necessary being, and so it's also necessarily true that God exists, and that moral facts would then be dependent on God's existence.
We won't even go to the ontological argument.
I didn't want to even go there, but what I mean by that is that it's that we can maybe we can try and conceive of a world where God exists, but as God does not exist even. But that doesn't mean that it's possible that God does not exist. And in fact, I would say that that it's impossible that God does not exist from the kind of different things in his nature.
We won't go into that.
No,
I mean, it is a bit of a sidetrack, but I do want to come back to this point also that Corey made. His sense is that we conceive of what a loving God would be by intuitively from our own experience of love and how we would act and feel it would be just and right to act in certain circumstances to avoid other people who we love suffering. So is this not a fair way of simply saying, I can have a good stab at what, if there were a God, he would,
not
David?
Not even that it's just, there's that over and above, like over the top, like aspect to it where we can justify it and talk about it morally speaking. But even if there isn't any moral, if there's nothing, morality is just completely an illusion. It seems to me that the concept, like when we still love people, and so it still follows from loving people that we would act in certain ways.
Well, let's see what Josh has to say.
Yeah, no, sure. I think that that this is where the kind of theism versus Christian theism kind of distinction gets in, and that if it's on the kind of loving God stuff, then I think that the theist kind of bare theism doesn't have to say that that concept of love is anything to do with it. And so I don't think it in the end becomes a problem for the bare theist. In terms of Christian theism, that I would say that Christian theism defines love in a way that doesn't say that suffering won't exist, but conceives of love being compatible with a world of suffering, a world where God uses good, evil to turn it to good, that we don't always know the reasons for that. I think we're in a bad position to know some of the reasons for that. But somewhere like Romans 8, for example, talks about, shall we say that Christ no longer loves us if we face trial or tribulation or calamity or persecution or death? It says, no, despite all these things, we are more than conquerors through Christ who loves us, and that nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. And so if that our intuitive concepts of love are helpful, but I would think that sometimes we do think that love can be permitted. Things like where we permit a child to hurt themselves so that they can learn more. We can permit people to have freedom so that they can love better, and lots of different reasons that we can think of and not think of that are compatible with the idea of a loving God there.
I mean, I think Alvin Plantinga and others have made the argument even that it's possible that the very best world we could live in is in fact the world in which Jesus Christ came and died,
yes,
to cover all of the suffering and evil and,
yeah,
and everything else in the world. And that may be a very different concept of what a loving God is,
right,
or should do,
right,
to an average atheist. They might say, no, that's awful. I can imagine much better worlds than that.
Right. Right, and one of the interesting things that's come here is that a recent argument that's been brought out by a guy called Trent Doherty has argued that this would then mean that if this, the best possible world, would require the existence of the kind of sufferings we see, he would say that evil, as we see it, would provide evidence for the existence of God over atheism, that so that we can have things like the cross, things where God can demonstrate his love for us. Even when these kind of evil seem pretty horrendous, that Christ was crucified and kind of tortured and betrayed by friends, that ultimately that served such a great good that we can see that how God can use horrendous evils for good.
What's your response to this, Corey? Because I'm imagining, yeah, you're going to come back with something, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but that this goes back to your point about gratuitous suffering, or what,
yeah,
appears to be, on the face of it at least, unnecessary, well, gratuitous suffering.
Well, there, again, there's a lot there, so I'll try to, maybe a few points. So one would just be that it's also possible that this is the worst of all worlds. You know, like, I don't, like that, I find that argument hard to take all that seriously. And I also imagine, like, how bad would the world have to be? Like, I can imagine a worse, like, the world far worse than it is, and someone could still argue that, well, maybe this is the best of all possible worlds. And I don't know where you would draw the line as to when, you know, when you would actually grant that, okay, well, no, this, maybe this isn't the best of all possible worlds. But I also think there's a little bit about the theism as opposed to the Christian theism thing. Now, I'm not going to get into this too much because it goes right back into Josh's main argument here, but I think that perfectly loving just follows from perfectly good, omnibenevolent. And so the standard theistic conception of God, omnibenevolent, omnipotent, and omniscient, I think loving would be entailed in that. But that's fine. I don't really need to, you know, to put much on that. If the theist, the general theist, is willing to discard the concept of loving, or any of the other three omnitrifecta qualities, then that's fine. And then the problem of evil works insofar as what it's trying to do. Because it's only trying to show the logical incompatibility, or the, you know, the unlikelihood of there existing a very specific type of God. And it says nothing about any number of other possible gods. I mean, there could be an evil God, there could be a committee,
yeah,
of gods.
The problem of evil does not affect Stephen Law's evil God hypothesis.
Yeah.
Sure, but what it specifically does address is the Christian God who does claim,
right,
to be a God,
right,
a God,
right,
of love, who cares, and, who, yeah, and so on.
Exactly. And so then another point is, this goes back to the first objection that we were dealing with, and Josh has brought up several times, like paper clips. And he talks about this in his paper too. I mean, what's the difference between just rocks and, you know, chemical stuff happening, going on, and the suffering of a human being in terms of a naturalistic worldview? And again, I'm not going to necessarily say I'm a naturalist, but let's just say that I am. It seems to me that there is a very obvious difference between a rock and a human being, or any animal. And mainly the difference is that the animal and human being are capable of sentient experience, and therefore that they're capable of experiencing subjective pain and suffering. And, I mean, it, insofar that a God would create beings with that capacity, right, It seems to me that there would be a difference between just the happenings of Brock and the suffering of his conscious creatures. And so, I don't see what the problem there is. I think there's a very clear difference between living beings and just other stuff happening in the natural world.
Let's give so Josh a chance to...
Even in a naturalistic view, I think these are different categories of things. Even if they're made up of atoms, the way they're made up is differently.
Sure. Well, let's give Josh a chance to respond on that issue.
Yeah, no, I agree that I'm not arguing that pain isn't that kind of there are creatures... that I'm not saying that creatures are the same as rocks, that's not what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing is that the idea that rocks are any less something that God would want to prevent the existence of rather than suffering, that I think, again, there's kind of this moral assumption brought in here that I agree that it's different, that there's sentient experience, that kind of suffering, that Corey's a vegetarian, I'm a vegan, and that we would agree that sentient experience is important. But why is sentient experience important? Because it is bad. Why is it? But if if some sort of atheism is true, where we can't have moral knowledge, then how can we know that that would be worse than rocks existing or paperclips existing? That's kind of the idea.
Yeah.
There.
So the point being then is, I guess Josh is trying to push you towards Corey acknowledging simply that to say that pain should be of interest to God over and above any other thing, you are automatically smuggling in again this moral fact about the matter. Why should God regard a physical fact of the world, pain in this case, neurons firing and producing what we know is obviously a sentient experience, but why should he regard that differently to a rock existing? I guess that's the question. What there's a should there, isn't it? God's should be doing something. And so I feel like we've got back to the moral thing again here.
Well, again, it pushes me back to the idea of a loving God. Like I don't grant, at least not yet, that when we speak about this concept of a loving being and what that being would do, I don't think that we are necessarily entering into the moral domain, because I think we can make sense of a moral, apostle state of affairs where morality is illusory, and yet we can still quite reasonably talk about what beings would do if they love. But I mean, and more importantly, this just goes back to the second point, and I didn't get all of his overall response there, but again, to some extent, I mean, this is true, that it is moral knowledge. Again, I'm just pointing towards certain things within the worldview of theism, or of Christian theism specifically. And so if Josh, it boils down to this, I mean, if Josh doesn't agree that the sort of God that he believes in would prevent gratuitous suffering, well, then my problem and the problem even general is just irrelevant to him. Okay, I perfectly grant that. But if he does grant that, and he doesn't have to grant, by the way, that gratuitous suffering exists, because again, I would be more inclined to run an evidential version of the problem of evil rather than a logical version. But insofar that he grants that within his worldview, that the sort of being that he believes would seek to prevent gratuitous suffering, even if it just seems to be the case in this world, well, then the problem of evil as an internal critique still seems to work. And so maybe I missed a little bit of what he was saying in response to that, but I still haven't heard in my ears a good rejoinder to that. And so I would stake my flag there still.
Okay. Do you want to come back?
Yeah,
on that?
I think that I would agree that I think within the Christian worldview, we have to question, would the Christian God prevent gratuitous suffering? I think that that's a yes. What I would argue, that I'm sympathetic to a view called skeptical theism, which says that we're not in a very good position to judge what would be gratuitous suffering. Now, there's lots of reasons for that. Within the Christian worldview, things like that sin, I would argue, affects our cognitive faculties and our ability to recognise what's good, what's bad. I would argue that God's very big within the world, Christian worldview, that it says in Isaiah 55 that my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. And so far as the heavens are above the earth, are my thoughts above your thoughts, my ways above your ways. And that if God is such a big being, and there is so much in this world which he can take into account, so many values to be working between, so many people to think about, so many actions to think about, and that I'm here with a kind of £3 lump of meat between my ears. And
I mean, the example I've used very often, just to boil it down to a much more simplistic level, is when I've spoken about the problem of suffering, is I remember when I had our third child and was born with a kind of condition, a bacterial infection which affected the skin.
Right.
And, you know, at just a few hours old, I had to watch a doctor inject insert a catheter into their arm.
Right.
The baby cried. I had to sort of be feeding him sort of a sugar solution to try and keep him calm. And I just wished I could explain to that baby, we don't hate you. You've just come into the world and we're already poking needles into you. And I've used that as an example of how, you know, we're in the position of the baby when it comes to God. We cannot see the bigger picture. And I think that's the basic argument you're making here, that there are so many facets that we're simply not in possession of the facts to know why there may be an ultimate reason for why God would allow even something as dreadful as a tsunami. Is that what you're saying here?
Yeah, and I think this is where I kind of try and bring all things within my theology back to the cross, and that looking at something like the cross looks pretty horrific, and that if I was looking on to the crucifixion that I kind of did study many years ago on methods of capital punishment because I was a sick child, and that having a look at that, I struggle to find anything more horrific than the crucifixion as a method of punishment. So looking at the way in which Jesus was tortured, the way in which he died, I think I would look at that and think, I can't think of a reason why that took place, that I just can't explain why there's such horrific suffering there. And yet the Christian worldview says that there was such a good reason for that, that people at the time wouldn't have been able to see that. There are many kind of other examples throughout the Bible, things like Joseph being sold into slavery. As he's sold into slavery, he's not able to see what the reason for that is. And later on, as he's talking to his brothers who sold him into slavery that he says to them that you intended it for evil, but God intended it for good, and that we're not able to see that, but it's still a good purpose.
Yeah, we're going to have to take another break, and we'll start to wrap things up in the next section. I'm sure Corey will want to respond to your defence there, Josh, of why you don't believe we necessarily ever can be justified in calling any evil gratuitous, given that we are not in a position to know what God may do. But thank you. It's been a really interesting discussion so far, hasn't it? If you want to get in touch yourself, respond, then I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch in the next part of today's programme. My guests, Josh Parikh and Corey Markham, as we ask, does the problem of evil presuppose God on Unbelievable this afternoon? Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable, the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio, and brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you'd like a free sample copy of the mag, premierchristianity.com/freesample. And the latest edition, the March edition, features an interview with George Osborne, where he talks about his early life in the grip of demonic possession. Now, I don't know what you think of that, but he has an extraordinary story to tell. In fact, he'll be telling it for me on the profile this afternoon between 4 and 5, straight after Unbelievable. But if you want to read it for yourself in his words, it's there at the website of Premier Christianity magazine, premierchristianity.com/freesample, to get a free sample copy. Just a reminder that Unbelievable the Conference also open for booking now. Unbelievable the Conference 2016, Discover Your Inner Evangelist. Really looking forward to having prolific evangelist Jay John joining us for that to share his wisdom, but also people like Gary Habermas, Jeremiah J. Johnston. We're going to be hearing from Ruth Jackson and Tanya Walker and many others as well. We're continuing to book in speakers, so look out for further details of more speakers to be released in due course. But it's going to be a range of topics that we'll be discussing. There will be that stream looking specifically at evangelism and how Christians can share their faith effectively, but there'll be issues around the Bible, science and faith, young people, and much more besides. So do book in if you can. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable 2016. A little later on, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback. If you come back next week at the same time, we're lining up a program, I haven't done this in quite a while, on sex outside of marriage. We're going to be asking, should Christians save sex for marriage? And we'll be meeting someone who says, actually, they're not sure they should. They're a Christian, Diana E. Anderson, but she's written a book on the purity movement in the USA, which she came out of herself, and is going to be talking about what she believes is the damaging effect that can be wrought upon young people and women in particular popular in a sort of shame culture, well, we'll have someone else opposite her to put the more traditional view of marriage and sex from a Christian perspective. So look out for that. We're in the process of arranging that on next week's programme. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So on today's show, we're discussing the problem of evil. Does the problem of evil presuppose God, we've been asking. And my guest, Josh Parikh, is saying, yes, it does. He's a Christian. He's an Oxford undergraduate. He's got a strong interest in apologetics. In fact, your interest in apologetics stems to things like the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group, doesn't it,
Josh? Yeah, that's correct. That I've really enjoyed that in the past, that I gave a talk a while back there on the resurrection and why I think the resurrection is really well evidenced and is rational and compelling to believe in. The next kind of Unbelievable discussion group is actually taking place on March the 14th, which is on the problem of evil once again.
I'm not talking on that one.
Two others are talking on that. I'm sure they'll be very capable of talking about it, but I'll make my way along.
I think if memory serves me right, Heather Tomlinson and Francis Janus.
That's the one. Yeah.
So they'll be speaking on that issue.
Maybe we'll see you there.
Who
maybe.
Knows? I may grace you with my presence. No, I mean, in all honesty, this was an initiative started completely separately to me, just show listeners, Ed Atkinson and others,
yep,
who wanted to create a forum where people actually got together in person to talk about these things. And that's great. And it is happening, as you say, Saturday, 14th of March, the next one in London. I'll give out the details again a bit later on.
So that's Monday, the 14th.
Monday. Sorry, did I say Saturday?
Yeah, you said Saturday.
I meant Monday, the 14th of March. I guess you're not flying in for that yourself, Corey, are you, on this occasion?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay. But Corey's been our other guest. He's an atheist, former Christian. Last time he came on the show, he was talking about intelligent design, having a crack at that. We ended up talking about the problem of suffering, though, and that's what he's been back to talk about. And just to pick up where we left off in that last part, Corey, effectively, Joshua was making what is a common response to the problem of evil and suffering when it comes to God, which is we don't know the mind of God. You are not in a position to say what is gratuitous suffering when it comes to God. Even something as awful as what you outlined at the top of the show, the tsunami that occurred. Who knows how, in his grand design and purposes, God may in fact be able to bring greater good out of that than the suffering that was involved. So what's your response to this common defense against the problem of evil?
Sure. Well, let me say first of all that I think among the different responses, so the defenses and theodicies that are usually employed in response to the problem of evil, I do think that skeptical theism is probably the best response. Not to say that I think it is a good response, per se, but I think it's the best response, and I think there's a few problems, though, with it. And so the first would be something that you, Justin, you know, again, you've already been exposed to plenty in the Stephen Law and William Lane Craig debate. A person who believes in, you know, all-powerful, all-knowing, perfectly evil God could just as easily and successfully run a sort of skeptical theistic argument as a sort of as if a smokescreen, if you will, avoid. So it would work just as well in that situation, and I think most of us grant that you know that wouldn't.
So that it could just as easily we could look at the same state of the world and say, well, it just shows that there's an evil God who. And the only reason you experience any joy is just so that the pain you experience is even worse, and so on. Yeah, and logically speaking, both could be possible, is what you're saying.
But more importantly, that one could run a skeptical theistic response to that just in precisely the same way.
Mm.
And I don't think that you know, it's not all that great of a response. I think most of us would admit that. But more importantly, because again, I don't believe in an evil God, and that's really just to sort of show how the skeptical theistic move can be used both ways. More importantly, I think there's skeptical theism, it's this sort of very, very radical skepticism, and it seems to me that it's ad hoc unless it's applied elsewhere. And so what I mean by that is that if it is the case that something is seemingly, obviously gratuitous, as, say, the suffering of baby bats, say, I'm not sure if you guys, I think Josh and I talked about this, but one of the more poignant examples of natural suffering and seemingly gratuitous suffering is the story that comes from a book, Dialogue on Good, Evil, and the Existence of God by John Perry. And essentially, it's this, it's a really good book. I would recommend to anyone who's interested in these issues. And it's written in the format of like a dialogue, almost like the Platonic dialogue. But essentially, the characters are talking about these issues. And at one point, the character that would sort of stand in as for me, the atheist character, and sure enough, it's the very grumpy negative person. So it's sort of perfectly appropriate. She talks about, I believe it's a she, there's this particularly horrible instance of suffering where in caves all around the world where bats take up residence, often they're there for very long periods of time. And what happens is you get layers and layers of excrement, of bat guano, or feces built up underneath all of the cats. I looked at my cat right when I said that. the bat, because the bats are perched on the ceiling. And so every once in a while what happens is one of these little baby bats will fall from their perch on the ceiling, and in falling, they'll end up breaking one of their wings. And what happens at that point, as you can imagine, is the baby bat basically suffers a horrible death where slowly asphyxiating from all the fumes and all the feces. And then usually what then happens is all the little creepy crawlers that live down in amidst the bat guano, they scurry forth and they basically eat the bat alive.
Mm.
Now, beyond the issue of whether or not the bat experiences suffering, because I'll grant that maybe there's an issue there, this is just one little example we can point to. And what the skeptical theist has to say is that they have to be extremely skeptical and say that, well, perhaps there's a reason for that. And I think if that is the case, if we have to be that skeptical about something as seemingly obviously gratuitous as that, well, then I don't know how we can have any of the sort of knowledge that is normally claimed in regard to God, whether that just be knowledge about the existence of God or more specifically, you know, germane to what we've been talking about this whole time, moral knowledge.
Okay.
And so in other words, if we take the skeptical theist route, I don't even know how Josh can even talk about his moral intuitions in the first place. So the very issue he was pointing at for the atheist seems to arise for the skeptical theist.
Okay.
Because how do we really know that something is evil?
Yeah.
It just seems evil. I mean, whether we're talking about the Holocaust or the tsunami or the suffering of baby bats, or whether we're talking about the children that, I mean, like every few seconds a child dies from, you know, starvation or you know, some preventable disease or illness, that all of that.
Yeah. Let's toss it back to Josh and see what he has to say.
Yeah, I think that the anti-God, evil God, as Stephen Law puts it, that my lecturer last year, Peter Millikan, talks about an anti-God, which I think is more helpful vocab for me, that I would want to be careful to kind of how I phrase skeptical theism. So I kind of was quite careful there to kind of quote the Bible on this, and what I would talk about is a positive skeptical theism rather than a negative skeptical theism. That I'm not standing here saying, oh, we can't know anything and we can't know this. That what I'm saying is that in light of the biblical revelation, we can know a number of things. That one of those things is that God exists, and we can know that God is love. We can also know that God is, to sum it, is his thoughts are above our thoughts, his ways are above our ways. We can also know that the law is written on our hearts. We can know a number of different things, and this would allow us to know all the things that Corey says that I can't know. So this would allow me to know what moral facts would be. This would allow me to know that God is good. This would allow me to know that kind of all these things have happened. And so the question would then be, what justification do you have for believing the Bible? And that I would point to the resurrection. I think there is enormously good evidence for the resurrection, that the habitual truthfulness of the Gospels, the persecution of the disciples, the empty tomb, the number and variation of the appearances, all, I think, point in one direction, and that direction is the resurrection for me.
Yeah, I mean, that takes us down again a whole nother route. We already did that with your tutor, Peter Millikan, actually, for you the bat example that Corey brought there, would you say yes, maybe even for the baby bat who dies, you know, in guano, eaten alive by bugs, even that there may be a reason for
it? Yeah, and that's, and again, that I kind of it's the centre of the Christian worldview, I think, is to come back to the cross, because looking at the cross, there is death there. It doesn't seem particularly redeemable. It seems enormously painful. There doesn't seem to be any good reason for it. Mm. And we're just not in a good epistemic position to judge that. I don't want to say that we could... that I don't want to say that God could allow gratuitous evil, and there could never be a world where there's so much suffering that God couldn't exist. But I just don't think we're in a good position to judge what a gratuitous suffering would look like because of the way we are.
I mean, this has taken us some way from the original question of right. whether the problem of evil does presuppose God, and if we're coming back to that, that's where you start with yes. this argument, isn't it, Josh? That if you're going to talk about an injustice, yep. evil, wrong, you've got to have something to ground that, and obviously we had that discussion earlier on in the program there, Corey, for that. Corey, yeah. I mean, as we start to wrap things up, then, I mean, where do you feel? Do you feel like, having had this interaction with Josh both today and obviously in the papers you've exchanged and things, that you're any more possibly persuaded by defences against the problem of evil? Or less?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that I'm less. I mean, as I said, I think Josh is a brilliant young philosopher, and I'm excited to see what he does. And I think, as I said, his take on this is a breath of fresh air in terms of... what's interesting is I think, like, I keep going back to that debate between Law and Craig. At one point, I think Craig concedes the point that I'm making that Law made, essentially that one can run the problem of evil without this sort of issue popping up. And I wonder if William Craig would change his stance on that upon reading Josh's paper. So I think
maybe,
Josh could send him his paper, and then maybe, yeah, that would be just a great trophy, if you will, for Josh to hold around. Hey, I changed William Craig's mind.
But you improved on a William Lane Craig argument, yes.
I want to stress is it just on some level the problem of evil to the extent to which it'll be persuasive to you, it very much depends on your view going in. So an atheist who doesn't believe in God, it's very hard for me to look at something like that suffering of the bat, and that's just one example. It's far more pressing and salient when you consider we can't truly consider, but just try to imagine the extent of suffering that occurs on our planet any given day. There are countless animals right now that are being eaten alive. You know, there are countless people that are suffering and starving and dying from diseases. And this is going back for millions and millions and millions of years, you know, long before humans are ever on the scene. And so this sort of suffering that we're talking about and the extent of it, it's hard for me to see there being any sort of reason for that.
Sure.
But I grant that if I believed in God, then it would be much easier for me to at least see or believe that there could be a possible reason for that. And so this is, interestingly enough, this is sort of a point that you almost seem to see borne out in the literature on this topic. It's not like it's just a full-on stalemate and everyone agrees that, you know, we're sort of got in a tie or a draw. But, I mean, this is the kind of a point that comes up a lot. And so I think that skeptical theism, it was interesting what he said there, because I still think that he's going to run into issues in terms of making any sort of moral claim.
We've got to draw it to a close. So thank you for being with us on the program today, Corey.
Thank you for having me on it. And Josh, we should continue this sometime.
absolutely.
Any final thoughts from you, Josh, for us as we close out?
Yeah, I think that I want to agree with Corey that there is an intuitive thing that we do think that this evil just does seem too much. And that's why I kind of, if I don't center things on the cross, if I don't center things on that kind of act of gratuitous evil, then I think that the problem of evil can sometimes run you slightly mad. And that the fact that God can use something so horrific for good means for me that he could do it again. And I would want to press Corey. Again, I'd always want to press Corey on this, is that, yes, there's all this animal suffering in the world, and I agree that's a profound problem. But is that a problem?
Okay.
And because that's a problem.
Why is that a problem in
Indeed.
The first place is the big question we've been discussing. Thank you very much, both of you. Been really interesting. Two really interesting young philosophers on both sides of the divide joining me today on Unbelievable. Well, perhaps you've got a view on it. Be interested to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the address to send your emails into. I will post up some links to both Josh and Corey where you can find out more about them with today's programme. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, thank you, Josh, and thank you, Corey, for being with me.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And don't forget, if you want to get in touch via Facebook or Twitter, @UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And loads of responses on Facebook and Twitter to last week's programme, where we were talking about whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God. Joseph Cummings coming down overall on the point of view that, yes, they do worship the same God. Nabil Qureshi, former Muslim himself, arguing no, they do not. A note here from Summer on Facebook, who said, just wanted to drop a note to let you know Saturday's debate with Nabil was fantastic. One of the best you've had in a long time. It was cordial, concise, educational, and just plain good. Thank you. I noticed on my Twitter feed, at least, most people were coming out in agreement with Nabil, that Muslims and Christians don't worship the same God. Having said that, Joseph Cummings, who was our other guest, posted it up on his Facebook page, and lots of people obviously supporting his perspective for that. Here's some of what came in via email. This was from John, who said, if we worship the same God, I question why Jesus said, love your enemy, and how Muslims kill Christians. Number two, how do Muslims remove Adam's sin without accepting Jesus? Ken Miller in Benfleet, Essex, says, keep it simple, please. The Quran denies the deity of Jesus. The Quran gets the Trinity wrong. The Quran carries extracts from the Bible, which it then falsifies. Muslims believe that the Quran has been inspired by their God, Allah. Christians believe the scripture has been inspired by the God of the Bible. If the Quran and the Bible came from the same spiritual source, it would make that source a deceiver. Therefore, they are from different spiritual sources. And This one from Bruce says, your choice of speaker was very interesting. Joseph Cumming coming from Yale, which was instrumental in replying to the common word with Miroslav Volf, who's a senior member of Yale Divinity School. Well, in fact, it was Miroslav Volf who put me in touch with Joseph. Now you mention it, Bruce. I had initially approached Miroslav for that discussion, but he suggested Joseph would be an admirable person to put that point of view across. And anyway, you say, in fact, Volf shares Cumming's view, and this is detailed in his book, Allah, A Christian Response, which I've read, and some extracts also from Steve Chalk's latest book on radicalism. And I consider that if you take their position of Muslims and Christians worshipping the same God to its logical conclusion, then they effectively must believe that the angel Gabriel really did speak to Muhammad. This would effectively make them Muslims. For their Christianity to maintain an internal consistency of believing that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, they must believe that God actually did give Muhammad his final revelation. I thought that what Nabil Qureshi said was very succinct and a logical position. He raised both the importance of who and what God is, and also to emphasise the writings in the Quran specifically undermine Christianity, which Cumming didn't seem prepared to address. And Nabil also raised the issue of the big white elephant in the room, which both Muslims and liberally minded Christians are not prepared to address, which is the violent surahs in the Quran that Muhammad received when he moved to Medina. Grace says, I recently got into a discussion with some Muslims at university when I started reading the display boards that they'd put up. Obviously, I had no desire to argue, but hoped that I might encourage them to question their own beliefs further, to question their personal rejection of Jesus. I asked why, for them personally, the many accounts, both inside and outside the Bible, of Jesus claiming to be God and of him dying and rising again, seem false, while the Quran, the writing of one individual, seemed credible to them. They were very keen to tell me that they follow Jesus as a prophet, and seemed keen to get across to me that we follow the same God, but they wouldn't give very clear answers to my question. They said that the science contained in the Quran proved that it was from God, and eventually told me that the Muslim explanation for Jesus' apparent death and resurrection was that God supernaturally transposed Jesus' face onto another man so that it appeared that Jesus had been crucified, but that he actually wasn't. I couldn't get an explanation of what evidence they based that idea on. Frustratingly, several told me that they believe it's because it's what Islam teaches, rather than that they'd formed their own conclusions. based on the evidence they'd found, which is what I feel strongly we all ought to do. The question, do we worship the same God, seems to me to be virtually impossible to answer, mainly because it requires a clear definition of worshipping God, which is a supernatural relationship or communication process that can't be fully captured by our human language. I felt for a while that it's possible that Muhammad was indeed spoken to by Yahweh, but was subsequently led astray by demonic spirits, hence his acts of brutality and his denial of Jesus. How can we know whether the relationship between a person and God is genuine or not? I think it may be possible that some Muslims have some relationship with Yahweh, but they're not accepting a crucial aspect of God's communication with them and a part of him since they reject Christ. Interesting stuff. Thank you very much, Grace. Nehemiah is Jewish and writes in to say, I enjoyed the discussion recently. If you asked most Jews today about whether Jews, Muslims and Christians all worship the same God, most would respond that Jews and Muslims certainly worship the same God, but it's unclear whether Christians do. I recently heard a prominent rabbi speak in Jerusalem on just this topic. I happen to believe Jews and Christians do share a common God and have been heavily criticised by some of my fellow Jews for that. I was surprised that Nabil kept referring to some hypothetical first century philo-type Jewish binitarian theology in order to justify why Jews worship the same God as Christians. I've never encountered this philonic theology in modern-day non-messianic Judaism. It seemed like Nabil was seeking fellowship with some non-extant Jewish straw man in order to contrast the Judeo-Christian God with the Islamic God. While a triune God is unknown in modern-day Judaism, Kabbalist Jews do believe in a Dekaun, 10-in-1 deity. Would Nabil accept that Kabbalists worship the same God as his triune God? And you say you look at this issue from a Tanakh, Old Testament perspective. The Israelites in the desert looked at the golden calf and proclaimed that it was the God who took them out of Egypt, celebrating a festival to Jehovah in its presence. Rather than worshipping a different God, they were perverting the worship of the true God Jehovah by worshipping him according to their own rituals rather than the ways he commanded them. In Hebrew, this is called Avodah Zarah, usually translated as idolatry, but literally meaning strange worship, which does not necessarily imply worshipping a different deity. Anyway, thank you very much. Interesting thoughts from you, Nehemiah. Thanks for emailing in. Maybe time for one more. Let's go for this one from Andrew. Says, it's sad to see a question such as this has caused so much chaos and disunity within the body of Christ. Very often, the reason a question is difficult to answer is because there's something wrong with the question. In this case, the problem is that it's ambiguous. It could have the following different meanings. Do Christians and Muslims recognize that there's one supreme being who created the universe and who revealed to certain persons mentioned in the Old Testament, such as Adam, Noah, Abraham, and Moses, and they intend to give glory to this being? Or secondly, do Christians and Muslims recognize that the one supreme being who created the universe is a Trinity, three divine persons in the one being of God, and do they intend to give glory to this being? Well, if the first is meant, then the answer is clearly yes, Christians and Muslims do worship the same God. If the second is meant, then the answer is clearly no, because Muslims deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Thank you very much. Other responses came in. No time to read them all, I'm afraid. But thanks for your interest in that programme, and great to have your feedback on it. For the moment, thank you very much for joining me on the programme today. A reminder that if you want to check out the Unbelievable discussion group, it's happening in London on Monday, the 14th of March. And the subject this time is the problem of evil again. So if you enjoyed today's programme, you might enjoy the discussion going on there. Details available from the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic discussion group on meetup.com. For the moment, thank you for being with me on Unbelievable today. Let me tell you what's coming up same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
We're asking, should Christians save sex until marriage? Well, we'll be meeting a Christian who doesn't believe that's necessarily the case. Diane E. Anderson has written a book on the whole issue, and we'll be hearing from a different point of view, a more traditional perspective as well. That's next week on the programme. Hope you can join me then. Do join me again if you can stick around between 4 and 5 for the profile next.